Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the, I like that. Welcome to the Transportation Committee. I'm Finance Committee. I'm Representative Hornstein. Today we have a couple of overviews. One involves the Itasca project, and we'll hear more about what that is and in their report. And then we'll hear from Greater Minnesota Transit. We didn't get into that very much when we had the Met Council and suburban providers, so we'll hear about that. And you hope to adjourn at or around, or maybe even slightly earlier than 11:30. And when we get a quorum, we'll do the minutes.
We do.
Okay. So, Representative Bernardi, have you had a chance to look at the minutes? I don't think there's a lot of controversy here.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Other than that Representative Earhart was excused.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes for February 14th.
Okay. We have a motion to approve the February 14th minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the minutes are approved. So our first presenter will be Jay Coles, the president of Unity Avenue Associates and member of the Itasca Project. So great that you can come and spend time with us and given your busy schedule. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for our record.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. My name is Jay Coles. I am the president of Unity Avenue Associates. I am also acting today as the volunteer chair of the transportation initiative of the Itasca project. I'll explain a little bit more about that as part of my presentation. I thank the committee very much for giving me this opportunity to present our recent study.
Proceed. But one before you start, Mr. Coles, I did want I neglected to introduce Clark Johnson, our newest member, and he's from St. Peter area, taking Representative Morrow's place. And just before we start with our presentations, I don't know if you want to say a couple words of introduction about yourself.
I will. I live in actually in North Mankato, and I it's really an honor to be here. I think you can appreciate that. I'm thrilled to be on this committee because we have a compelling need in Nicola County. Highway 14, I bet you've heard of Highway 14 before. It's a dangerous road. I just want to be real take a serious moment for a while. First of all, it's a commercial road, and there's a lot of product that moves on that road. But I just want to share with you the human tragedy that we have felt as a larger community with just a series of deaths on that road that are just remarkably sad. I made my calls on my campaign, and I called one of the families that had lost family members on that road, and she just begged me to do something about it. So I don't want to be overly focused in this moment, but that's obviously important. I just wanted to share that with you. Thank you very much.
Thanks. And you had anticipated my next question, which was if there's any particular issues in your district related to transportation that you wanted to share with us. So. Welcome to the committee. We're so happy to have you here, and look forward to getting to know you a little better. And congratulations on your election. And with that, Mr. Coles, proceed.
Thank you very much. Well, let's see. Here we go. This is the agenda. I believe everybody has a printed version of the remarks that I'm going to make in front of them, but I'll scroll through this on the screen as well. Itasca project, as I said, let me give a brief introduction for those of you who aren't familiar with it. Itasca is about 10 years old, and it is an employer-led civic alliance focused on building a thriving economy and quality of life in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro region. And reducing and eliminating the socioeconomic disparities. It is made up of roughly about 50 participants led by private sector CEOs. Our current chair is Richard Davis, the CEO of U.S. Bank. Previous chairs include Mary Brainerd, Health Partner CEO, Jim Campbell, retired CEO of Wells Fargo, Minnesota. And we include some key public sector leaders, as you can see in the slide, as well as the leaders of several of our major foundations in the United Way. Itasca Project, over the course of its 10 years, has attempted to respond to these goals that are identified in the center of this triangle. Again, raising the economic competitiveness and quality of life in the metropolitan region, and reducing and eliminating disparities. In the last few years, we have been consistent in the three goals that you see identified here. But I will say that the second goal in the lower left-hand corner, as you look at it, regarding transportation, has in fact been one of the top goals of the Itasca Project since our founding 10 years ago. And the reason for that is something that, of course, this this committee is quite familiar with. The transportation system of the metro region impacts the economic health and vitality at a very deep level. A comprehensive, integrated, and efficient transportation system is an important driver of economic development and job growth because it connects employers to the workforce, it provides access for employees to employment, it maintains timely movement of goods, it attracts and retains residents by providing greater diversity of travel options. And it also enables strategic, efficient investment in long-term, both long-term infrastructure, both in the private and public sector. And we've heard testimony even in this session from the leaders of Greater MSP, the Regional Economic Development Agency, that when employers examine where to locate, strong transportation infrastructure is one of the top three considerations, top three criteria that are used by business in viewing their relocation or their expansion needs. In this mix of viewing the entire transportation system here in the metropolitan area, transit is becoming increasingly critical to sustaining the economic vitality of the region. In Minnesota, transit already plays a vital role. You can see that 40% of downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul commuters use transit. I know in Minneapolis, given their projected growth in residents and business development, they are targeting 60% of their daily commuters to be using transit by the year 2025. According to the Met Council, transit riders are currently more than one-third of the peak hour users of our major freeway. But transit will become even more important in the future. For instance, and I'll get to this in the report, building out the transit system as envisioned in the 2030 Met Council plan would give regional employers access to an additional 500,000 people within a half-hour commute. We'll describe this a little bit later, but the point is it provides greater access to the existing labor pool. It provides greater access to existing jobs for people who live in the area. And increasingly, what we know is that certain demographics, and we call out here the millennial generation, certain demographics are particularly seeking cities with transit. And this is going to be an important distinction in the future years when the competition for labor is going to become ever more fierce, particularly among our highly educated, highly mobile employees of the future. Transit also can be a cost-efficient way to add capacity in corridors, improving travel times across the system. We'll discuss that in a moment. And what we see as we look across the country is that our competitor regions are investing heavily in transit, such as Denver, Salt Lake, and Dallas, and these are all rapidly growing dynamic regions, much like the Twin Cities. As Itasca was asking itself what it could do to advance thoughtful discussion about transportation and transportation investment in the Twin Cities, our task force members concluded that it might be valuable to actually attempt a conservative business-like analysis of the return on investment that the investment in a 2030 Met Council transit plan might in fact generate. And so we commissioned such a study and paid for it. We had a national search for an expert firm, McKinsey & Company, which is an international consulting company that supports Itasca Project, had an RFP nationally. We selected Cambridge Systematics, which is a very highly regarded, incredible transportation economic consultant. And we developed a local technical advisory committee to help us review with the Cambridge Systematics staff the precise assumptions and framing of this study so that they would meet the test of being reasonable and conservative.
And we'll try to take questions, if it's okay with you, Mr. Coles, as they come, or would you?
Yeah, I welcome through questions at any time.
Okay. So Representative Beard has one.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We're going to be talking a lot about transit, I suspect, this session. And as you know, I am a little skeptical of some of the claims that I think are a little over the top on transit investment, although I am very much aligned with transit where it makes sense and the investments we need to make there. Mr. Chairman, as we've talked before on the philosophical and the social good paradigm of looking at things, but one that always kind of amuses me or makes me raise the question is this ROI. Those of us that have looked at payback and have actually had to invest our dollars in machinery or devices or a new way of doing things, we look at numbers a certain way. I'm thinking of when I upgraded my last desktop publishing system. It was a multi-$1,000 investment. I looked at the time that I'd save, the bandwidth I'd save, and how much more production I could get out of my employees. And I put that all together, and it came up to something like 24 or 26 months. I can't remember. It was a no-brainer. I went out and refinanced my truck, and I put down the money because I knew I was getting that back. I see this number, though, and I wonder, are we using the same metric here? Because if this is the case, I hear numbers 6 to 1, 10 to 1, things like that. This would be a no-brainer. And even crotchety old Republicans like me, Mr. Chairman, would be saying, let's borrow the money and do this. Mr. Coles, tell us how Cambridge Systematics measured this and how this ROI actually relates to real-world experience so that I can get my mental arms around it and be supportive of what it is you're talking about.
Good, super, thank you. And if it pleases the representative and the chair, I will do that as part of the next few slides.
Good, thank you.
Why don't you come back if you have any specific questions?
I will.
And Representative Beard, I think you really are asking the critical question. What's the methodology?
Yes.
And I think that's what's unique about this report and why I wanted the committee to hear it. So thank you for asking that, and I think it is worth some time, Mr. Coles, and so please take the time you need to answer Representative Beard's question.
And I'm happy to take questions in that regard. I absolutely agree with the representative's thrust of his remarks. So here are the three questions that we framed for our study. What would be the return on essentially building out the 2030 plan by the year 2030? Secondly, if in fact there was a way to accelerate that build out, would that change the return on investment? In our scenario, we used the year 2023, 7 years faster. And then thirdly, if we found, as has been the case in many cities that have built out more complete transit systems, that their growth within the region, particularly within the local areas, would tend to cluster at the transit stations to a higher level than would occur without the transit stations being there, would that in fact change the return on investment further as well? I might add that we're looking at a time period out to the year 2045 and calculating our results in all of these scenarios. So the base case is the current transit options and assuming that Central Corridor is completed. The 2030 plan includes three additional LRT lines, four completed BRT corridors, and nine arterial BRTs. There are no additional commuter lines assumed in this scenario. But I would point out that the bulk of the mileage of transit capacity that is added here is bus-based. The second case, as I said, shows acceleration of the plan for construction to the year 2023. And then in the case of the third plan, we are taking surrounding economic growth and reallocating 25% of it to those station areas. This is within the local, excuse me, I want to silent my sometimes bothersome phone, to represent what could occur should the private market see advantages to, as we've seen in other communities, to putting housing, jobs, and other development around these stations. So this is roughly a map of the current transit system. You can see the Menn Pass in purple, the commuter line to the north in North Star, the green and blue lines, and then the red line, the Cedar BRT line, which is runs down to Apple Valley. This, in turn, is a representation of what the 2030 plan might entail, or the corridors that are currently under study. Our analysis does not presume to answer the questions of what will be the right technology and the right corridors, but we're measuring the impact of capacity on our region, given experiences in other cities. Representative Beard, here, these are the six kinds of direct impacts that were measured, and what we wanted to do was focus on impacts that had the strongest research correlation and therefore seemed conservative to us. Vehicle operating costs, obviously, as people move to transit and drive their cars less, there's reduced vehicle operating costs. Travel times and travel reliability, similarly, as people find that they move to transit and find more efficient ways to get around. But we also find, and this is one of the really important things to understand, is that in building out transit capacity, you are in fact contributing to more effective use of your road capacity. So much of the travel time improvement is on the basis of your congested, in particular, your congested major road and highway corridors being able to flow more freely as a result of more people relying on the transit system for their daily commutes. In addition, there are shippers and logistics costs, which can be measured, emissions impacts, safety costs, even road pavement conditions because of the reduced usage of the roads and highways. We worked with the Metropolitan Council to develop costs for each of these scenarios, and I should say that all of the investment costs that are used in our study include not only the capital costs, but also the operating and the maintenance costs through the entire period to the year 2045.
We have an additional question from Representative Howe, and I just see that Representative O'Neill has a question, too. Is this an okay time to take?
Always. Absolutely.
Okay. Representative Howe first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question kind of relates to Representative Beard's question, and I noticed on slide 6 where it says the transit return on investment study, and having been involved in return on investment studies, I see there that it's guided by the Technical Advisory Committee, and they have a big impact on how that study is conducted normally. Can you tell me how many people on that Technical Advisory Group are actually private enterprise folks instead of public sector people?
I think if you look at slide 22, which is the last slide of your of this study, you'll see the list of people on that study. Obviously, we had McKinsey staff. We had myself and Charlie Zelli, the current MnDOT commissioner, who was at that time co-chairing the task force with me. We had representatives of the Minneapolis Chamber as well as the Minnesota Chamber. We had obviously staff from the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota, as well as staff from a number of the counties and Met Council.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. I have kind of a three-part question. Can you tell us what the current percentage of ridership is on the transit system? Total percentage. And then in your calculating these direct impacts, where does that needle move? What percentage does that move it from if we're at 1.5% or something now, ridership on transit? What does that move it to? And can you tell us, in the best case scenario, what is the max percentage of transit that's actual numbers that we've found in the United States? And I've heard numbers around 4%, and maybe you can either say if that's accurate or not, 4% total ridership.
Thank you very much. Chair Hornstein, I don't have those precise numbers in that form because for the purpose particularly of this study, we were not studying aggregate totals like that as much as we were studying actual experience and behavior in terms of people's use of the transportation system. So that the impact of these investments is greatest for those people who move throughout the metro system during the high peak, the commuter hours, primarily but not exclusively along your major corridors between your housing centers and your employment centers. And so I don't have the answers to those questions. I could get those if it pleased the chair, but that's not the scope and the manner of this study.
Follow up, please. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, and I just emphasize, one of the key figures that Mr. Coles had mentioned and we've heard before, in Minneapolis, on a daily basis, 40% of the people that are commuting into downtown are using transit. So, you can use figures all kinds of ways, but, I think that's certainly one that would potentially grow, and I think that's maybe one of Representative O'Neill's questions is, do we anticipate that number perhaps growing as well as the other aggregate numbers that you were talking about? Representative Petersburg, I saw that you had a question.
Thank you, Chairman. I think I heard something that intrigued me a little bit, and I think what I heard you say is that our return on investment tends to be highest during commuting times, which kind of begs the question to me, in today's mobile society and technology society, we don't know exactly what the commuter needs might be in the future, and certainly we don't want to have congestion. But am I correct in what you're saying, though, if the need for congestion or the congestion needs reduce, that this may not have as big a return on investment?
We could speculate about that. I would say that the trend here in the metropolitan area has not reflected that. I had a question in another committee about the role of telecommuting, for instance, and whether that might have an impact. The telecommuting was, in fact, considered as part of the trends that was evaluated by the Met Council in developing their ridership projections along with the population growth of the region, for instance. Another important point of backdrop for this discussion as we consider a 20- and 30-year strategy is that we're projected to add another 900,000 residents to the metropolitan area over the period of the next 20-25 years. I'm sorry, I just forgot the question. I'm sorry.
My question was I'm sorry, thank you, Chairman. I'm sorry. My question was if the future changes occur that may require less, that actually produce less congestion, would the return of investment be reduced?
Telecommuting to this point, to the best of our the latest estimate that I have seen, suggested perhaps 5% of the workforce was telecommuting. But I've also seen reference to a 1993 report, which would have been some 20 years earlier, that suggested 9% of the workforce was telecommuting at that time. So it's not clear that it's a trend that is producing, that is increasing or decreasing, and we certainly don't have any evidence that it is correlated with ridership in use of the transportation system. Indeed, areas like Silicon Valley and areas that obviously have a very high intensive use of technology, if anything, have the same kind of growth in transportation needs as we do.
Okay. Thank you. Representative O'Neill has a follow-up, I believe.
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah.
So I'm still just trying to understand. I know that you don't have percentages change or anything, but I'm sure that you must have based these six direct impacts on some numbers, some hard numbers of this is our ridership, this is the congestion, this is what we would alleviate the system. Do you have any raw data to say we started at this much, you know, this many trips in the system and we reduce it by this much and that's what we based this information on? You must have had something to come up with all these direct impacts because they're all based on less cars on the roads. And so do you have any raw numbers at all as to how you arrived at that so we could see what that is?
Thank you, O'Neill, Representative O'Neill. Chair Hornstein, we'd be happy to make the complete report available to the committee. It is a very detailed analysis. In terms of the base projections for the Minneapolis-St. Paul region, we relied on the Metropolitan Council's travel demand models, which project out over this period of time, at least through 2030, but I believe they go out to 2045. So the Met Council is the source of our raw data, and they work very closely with the consultants to make sure that, and the consultants evaluated their data to make sure that it was reasonable input from their standpoint compared to the quality of data that they would expect to get for a study of this kind in other cities. And the consultants had done similar kinds of studies in a number of other cities as well. So this was not an unusual request. In terms of the projections, those are drawn from research studies of the behavior of actual transit investments that have occurred in other markets and what they observed in terms of changes in ridership, usage of transit, and I would have to call all of our attention back to the detail in that report in order to identify the precise sources of data. But I would say that your technical advisory committee reviewed all the key inputs. We reviewed whether or not these particular kinds of direct impacts were viewed as viable, measurable financial results. The fundamental formulas of calculation were also reviewed by that group to make sure that it had viability.
Thank you. It's an important topic to discuss, and you know, for example, I think we're up to, and I don't remember when Mr. Shetland was here, the Met Council was here, I don't remember what the number was, but I think we're up to 80 to 90 million rides on Metro Transit now, and that number is increasing. And as a result of Hiawatha, 10% of all rides now are light rail. So, you know, again, these are important questions. I think the trend, you know, and we will look at that data, and I think, you know, Representative O'Neill and others can look closely at the assumptions and the raw data that you have. But it's clear that there are trends towards increased ridership with increased service, and particularly the rail choice, once it's on the table, has had astronomical increases far beyond what was ever projected, at least on the Hiawatha. So, and we'll look forward to seeing if that continues to be the trend with Central Corridor. Representative Hausman, I know you might have had a point as well here.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've seen some of these Cambridge systematic studies, and I mean, we're getting a little taste of it, and we're not quite letting him give us the full picture yet. And I don't know whether what it would cost us if we had Cambridge systematics in or saw the full report, but I mean, the detail of the questioning, I think, goes far beyond sort of an executive summary. But I do think it's important just again to look at slides 21 and 22. The group that that began, that was motivated to look at this, SuperValue, Xcel Energy, United Health, Murphy Warehouse, U.S. Bancorp, CenturyLink, Ignite Foundation, Target, Jefferson Lines, Health Partners, that's the level of business that wanted to have an understanding. I suspect they know something about statistics and results and business plans that come out of this. And then, of course, I think you've also had the St. Paul Area Chamber, the Greater Minneapolis, and the Twin West.
Yes.
There's a sort of a vast business investment in looking at this. So whether we have the broader presentation, I know we've had a lot of these statistics given to us by some of the previous testimony. I certainly hope that we take seriously the level of input we're getting here and that it does inform our thinking.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll take Representative Mahoney's question. And then what I'd like to do, members, is I'm pleased with the all of these questions, but we do have some folks that have come from Duluth and other places that I want to make sure we get them in a little after 11 o'clock. So we'll have Representative Mahoney's question. We'll let Mr. Coles finish his presentation, and then we'll reserve some time at the end for additional questions. So, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a few questions, and I can certainly catch up with anyone from the Itasca group. They entail some of the business development that goes along with these transit corridor lines, and what you would, were streetcars figured into this particular transit project question. But I can't miss the opportunity to build on Representative Beard's comment on ROI. And I really wish there was some other thing that you could talk about with ROI, and here's the reason why. I chair the Jobs and Economic Development Committee, and I actually just, on the back of an envelope, took all the ROI that all the job training programs put together, and frankly, it almost totaled my whole budget with all the business development and everything, how much we would save if we just went along with their job training projects. It was quite amazing to get up into the $800 million worth of savings that would create. So ROI kind of becomes an in one ear and out the other kind of number up here. So as an FYI, if there's some other way that we can quantify that, because it becomes so, everybody's got an ROI. It's the, you know, it's the latest and best, next best thing. So a word of advice, not a question.
Okay.
Not an answer.
So proceed, and then we'll again hold our questions so we can have Mr. Coles get through the presentation.
Thank you very much. The slide you can see that I'm on is the direct impacts, the results. The investment for the 2030 plan is at $4.4 billion with a return. We estimate a low return based upon those six direct impacts that we described of $6.6 billion to $10 billion over the period of that we are measuring, with an internal rate of return of 7.8% to 15%. You can see that the accelerated regional plan looks like a higher investment, and it is, because if you build this system in a shorter period of time, the capital costs are not greater, but you're incurring seven additional years of operating costs and maintenance costs of the system. Therefore, it's a higher investment, but you're also gaining seven additional years of the calculated benefits. And those increased to 10.8 to 16.5 billion for an even higher internal rate of return. And then looking at the 2030 plan with growth near the stations, same investment as in the original 2030 plan, same time period assumed, but you can see that this is just as the businesses may choose to, or and other developers may choose to invest near the transit systems hubs. In aggregate, all the users of the transportation system will appreciate an even greater return for this kind of investment, and we get to a 13-21% internal rate of return. I might add that we do not calculate as part of our return any imputed economic growth, so that the economic growth referred to in the third scenario is simply the projected Met Council growth for the economy over this period of time, simply being allocated by the private market, not by us, in response to the transit system being built in a way that we have seen in other cities. We're not causing it to happen by this plan, but we're suggesting that this might be a scenario that would occur in the Twin Cities similar to other regions. If you look at the direct impacts by category, obviously the travel time savings and reliability are the biggest contributor to the benefits. These occur for businesses who have workers that are trying to get around town, delivery trucks, as well as the general residential population, which is using the entire transportation system and is saving time. And there's a calculation of the rate of wage that ought to be imputed with this savings in time that's provided by the U.S. Department of Transportation. It's been verified in a variety of other research reports as well that Cambridge can bring forward. And the point here is that the benefit in travel time accrues to all users of transportation, not simply transit users, which tends to be the focus of a discussion like this. Gee, we're making this investment just for the benefit of the transit users. In fact, this is similar. I like the metaphor of the human body and its circulation system. In this case, by adding this transit capacity, it is the equivalent of adding a few well-placed, large-capacity veins and arteries in the body that permits faster, efficient blood flow throughout the circulatory system, regardless of whether it's a capillary or a vein or an artery or whatever the mode of transportation. So that we find, and this is going to be important for that secondary benefit about access to jobs, access to employers that I described earlier. But you can see there's a number of measurable impacts in all of these categories. This is the point that I made earlier. Because the entire system is more efficient in providing mobility to its residents, there is a projected increase in working age population accessible to employers within a 30-minute commute. So those 35-minute commutes now become 30-minute commutes for a larger area for the average resident. Therefore, they have more access to job opportunities, either whether it's transit or by car, and in turn, those employers who are looking for employees, particularly 10, 20 years from now, I think a very competitive market for employees, will find that they can look within the existing residential base for an even greater labor pool for their needs. Here are some of the additional impacts that are not considered in our results, and these benefits that we're just calculating. We do not make any allowance for the fact that if you make this investment, you're injecting $4.3 billion in construction investment and that resulting economic activity. That is outside and would be, to the extent that could be captured, that would be presumed to be an additional benefit if we thought that was the best use of those investment dollars. And that represents 30,000 construction FTE job years. And that obviously would be significant as well. I might add that our ROI is agnostic about where the investment dollars come from. The benefits that I just described are virtually all benefits to local residents and businesses in the metro area. But in fact, the dollars that we're calculating as a return against are not identified. To the extent that we're able to access federal dollars as a portion of that capital build-out of these transit system investments, then the ROI, as it were, of state and local dollars, if you were measuring just that, would be an even higher number. But we have not attempted to calculate that because we don't know how that might what might happen there. And as I said earlier, the ROI does not consider induced growth. We can look at examples like Central Corridor or other transportation projects. Central Corridor is reporting $1.2 billion in building permits that have been pulled as of this date for the Central Corridor, which hasn't even opened. In some fashion, we can calculate or we can imagine that there would be some positive benefits. In addition to the quantitative side, we interviewed businesses to ask what their views were about the importance of transit. Number one was transit is important to their ability to attract employees. These are a number of quotes. These are businesses located throughout the metropolitan region. You can see some of the company names at the bottom. Obviously, it is part of their it is an important attribute for them as they look for workers and as they attempt to retain workers. In addition, some businesses are interested in higher density development, which transit in particular permits. And for certain kinds of activities, certain industry groups, that's important. But this last point, transit must be connected to and aligned with destinations and other modes of transit, is really important. Business is very aware, as users of the transportation system, that it's the connections between the transit and transportation modes. It's that last half mile. It's providing access. It's providing ease of use that, in the end, creates the real utility of the system, not just laying down a track or a bus rapid transit system corridor. This is a summary page of what I have just reviewed with you, and I'd be happy to take questions, Chair Hornstein, or...
Sure.
Elaborate on any point.
Thank you so much. Yeah, let's take a few minutes, members, for this, and then we'll hear from our next set of presenters on the agenda. But we'll start with Representative Beard, kind of go full circle.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to tell Mr. Coles, thank you for slide number 15 and your comments there, because it helps us, Mr. Chairman, I think, identify that some of the things that would be happening probably dollars being spent in other ways. We could count the economic impacts and so on of jobs and construction jobs and other things that need to be done as well, given that our limited bonding ability, you know, with 3% of general fund and so on, to be prudent. However, the construction that would happen, and I've got to tell you, Mr. Chair, that there will be things happen if we do make these investments. We do build fixed guideway systems that the government operates. Stuff will happen. That's a given. The thing, though, that I think you underscored here was that there is then an opportunity to engage in what we call value capture. And I think our friends at CTS, Center for Transportation Studies, did a fascinating report that we heard last year or the year before. We may want to revisit, Mr. Chair, on the ability to use value capture as one of the mechanisms to identify the dollars that would be invested. As Mr. Coles pointed out, this report doesn't identify where the dollars come from, but that if we do dollars, things will happen. And, Mr. Chair, one of the fears I have is that we're asking people in Slate and their sleepy eye to pay for stuff on the general obligation bonds that have some benefit, admittedly, to the metropolitan area. But perhaps there is another way that is a little more equitable, that if people are benefiting by putting a station, for instance, on the SuperValu campus or the United Healthcare campus, that there is a method actually to capture back some of that value that may accrue in the future that helps us put our money, I guess, where we think our where we think the future is going, we can actually bet on that happening. So that is one method I think it would be great for this committee to explore going forward. And that's just a comment. Mr. Chair, I'm not asking a question or anything, but I just want to say thank you for clarifying that in your comments, and thank you to my colleague, Mr. Mahoney, for also clarifying the comment that ROI means something to people who actually invest their own money. And using it in this way is a little bit of a stretch, and I think causes a little confusion, because we look at paybacks that are usually in the 2 to 5 year range. I think it's good for the committee to note that this actually anticipates 2045. In my business, I would never contemplate an investment that paid back in 2045. I would leave it to my grandkids and wish them well, and they can make that investment as they get closer to 2045. But point well made, point I think it would be good for all the testifiers going forward to take, is that ROI means something to people who are risking their own capital. It apparently means something else whenever the government is talking about risking capital. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
I don't know if you had a comment. We have Representative Mahoney wanted to talk.
I think, Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Beard, that would be a delightful way to look at things, but could we also please look at the $300 or $400 million we invest in sewers and waters outside the metro area in small towns? I mean, fair is fair. If you want to do that, I'm ready to go.
Yeah. Good discussion. Yeah.
Yes, I think, well, we'll leave it at that. are there some additional questions or comments for Mr. Coles in the study? Okay, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As this build out occurs, I didn't see it in the study anywhere, but maybe it's included in part of it. But what's the return on investment for integrating all these systems? Because right now, the light rail, the bus, the North Star Rail don't coordinate each other. They stop at the same station, but they don't talk to one another. What's the return on investment to getting those folks talking to one another and actually having an integrated system?
Mr. Coles.
Well, this study does not parse at that final level, but I believe that the amount of money that we're talking about would be able to address a number of those issues as we know them today. I think it's important to keep in mind that while this is a very long-term analysis in terms of the year 2045, as Representative Beer pointed out, we're now being prescriptive about the precise technology that's being, other than a certain amount of light rail, a certain amount of bus rapid transit, but the greatest amount of investment here is in bus capacity at 1% a year, as well as of buses, as well as arterial bus lines. That's the greatest amount of mileage in this system. So that's flexible. I know that there are conversations about this issue that are ongoing. I think exactly where those investment dollars would come from, whether it would come out of funding a 2030 plan as constructed by the Met Council or in other ways, is for this committee to opine about. But I think it's an important point in the views of employers that the utility is going to be of any system is going to be measured not just by the miles of roadbed, but literally by the usefulness of to the riders who want to rely on it on a regular basis.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Howe, I appreciate your question and I want to thank you for your study. It's very helpful and highlighting the importance of an integrated multimodal transportation system when all the systems and entities are working together so that it's the best system possible for the user. So thank you for your work on this. And I especially noted transit must be connected to and aligned with destinations and other modes of transit. We need to hear that message often because that's how it makes it safe and efficient and really usable for the citizen of Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions of the committee? Yes, our new member.
I'll try,
Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Go for it,
Mr.
This
Chairman.
Is historic members.
This is my first comment in committee, and I'm interested in this. I'm interested in this as a citizen of North Mankato, and I'm picking up on the last comments. Think of the occasional rider. I really think this has value to people who live in my district, which is about 70 miles away. And the occasional rider who needs to understand the system well as coming every month or every 2 weeks for that to have value, because I do see a day where folks from my area drive to the edge of the Twin Cities. I see a day actually where we ride transit to the cities, but related to this plan, I see where increasingly my neighbors are driving to the edge of the Twin Cities and then using a system. And we want a high-quality system that can take us where we need to go, but one that we can understand. Thank you.
Thank you. Great. Well, with that, members, I, again, want to thank you so much, Mr. Coles, not only for being generous with your time spending it with our committee, but I think this is an important study, and I was very pleased that the committee wants to even get even deeper into it. And I know that certainly we'll continue to be in contact, and I think Representative Beard would like to be as well. And, we appreciate it greatly, and I think this really adds a lot of value to our discussion. And we haven't had a study like this, I think, about transit in the past. So it's very, very helpful, and I'm very appreciative of your time.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you, Committee, for your time.
Thank you. Okay, with that, members, we will move on. I don't think we're going to run out of time today, but just as a insurance policy, I want to make sure that we get our guests from St. Cloud and Duluth up first. So, and we will very likely have time for Mr. Schadenauer, but I know he's local and can potentially come back. But for the people that did travel, I want to make sure you have as much time as you need, and the committee has as much time with you as we need. So with that, we'll start. And both of you could identify yourselves for our record, and I don't know who wants to go first, but I'm sure have coordinated this, so please.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein and members of the committee. I'm Tony Kellen. I'm the Director of Operations at St. Cloud Metro Bus, and I'm also, for the past 7 years or so, president, volunteer to serve as an elected president of the Minnesota Public Transit Association.
I'm Dennis Jensen. I'm the General Manager of the Duluth Transit Authority.
Thank you. And members, just by way of introduction, again, we've had overviews of the metropolitan transit systems. We haven't in Greater Minnesota, and of course, we have our regional centers that are very, very important and often get overlooked. And so we want to make sure that the committee is aware of these systems and their challenges. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, is the Arrowhead Transit also here, or are they not present today?
Mr. Chair, Arrowhead Transit is not here. I will be making a couple comments in there.
Okay. That's helpful, Representative Hausman. Thank you for asking. Okay, so we'll start with St. Cloud.
Mr. Chair, if you would permit me, I do have a handout going around presented by Minnesota Public Transit Association.
Okay.
Similar to what was shared with the TFAC committee
okay.
A few months ago.
So this is separate than this red.
Yeah, and then I'll do the St. Cloud specific okay. presentation after that, sir.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Appreciate that.
And actually, if that has not gone out yet, I can go ahead and do the St. Cloud presentation. Why don't I do that, Chair Hornstein?
Okay.
I'll just go ahead and do St. Cloud. Again, thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here and talk about our specific transit system in St. Cloud. I've been the Director of Operations there for about 15 years, been employed by Metrobus since 1983, so I have a long history with Metrobus. The first slide is a picture of a new Flyer bus. That's our newest model coach that we have in St. Cloud. We just also put in an order for 10 additional New Flyers, which will bring our fleet of New Flyers to 20 in St. Cloud. This is our ridership trends. As you can see, we are a growing agency, have grown phenomenally since 2000. We have had year-over-year growth pretty much sustained, with the exception of one period of time over the last decade. Our dial-a-ride system grows as well as our fixed route system. Our dial-a-ride system is the federally mandated ADA complementary paratransit that's required within 3/4 of a mile of fixed route systems would be your elderly and disabled trips. So 2.3 million trips we're projecting for 2015. We just finished the year 2012 with around 2.3 million trips on our fixed route, 135,000 trips on our dial-a-ride. Our funding sources are 53% of our funding comes from the state of Minnesota DOT. We receive about 20% of our funding from the federal government. We do levy a property tax. St. Cloud Metro Bus is a public transit authority created about the same time as MTC, around the same time as Duluth in 1969. I think Metro Transit was created maybe a year or two earlier than that. Locally, with transit and other fares, we collect $1.8 million, or about 19% of our budget, $9.5 million budget in St. Cloud. We do a lot of service with St. Cloud State University, both in their surface parking lot transportation, as well as our U-Pass program, which you'll hear about from Duluth as well. We've had close to 5 million trips on our U-Pass program since 2007 at St. Cloud State. So they're a big part of our business. We've been able to really make the campus there congestion-free and eliminate the need for numerous parking ramps on that campus. This slide here is a slide that shows a budget gap. If you remember going back, we have about 53% of our overall funding comes from MnDOT. And this can get a little bit confusing to look at, but after your revenues and federal funds are taken away from your overall budget, MnDOT is, by statute, supposed to participate in about 80% of our service for our fixed route, 85% of our service for our dial-a-ride, with a required 15 or 20% local share. Going back to 2001, prior to the tax reform on property taxes, when MVEST started to be used to supplement, MnDOT had a percentage of 60% and 65%. So with that change back in 2001 and 2, there was a greater obligation placed on the state through reducing property taxes. And so what has happened over the years since 2002 in St. Cloud is we've continued to have to raise our property tax levies and fares in order to make up that gap in funding. So that gap amounts to about $1.8 million. If the state were to fund their full statutory obligation. So what is done throughout the entire state is budgets are submitted, and not all those budgets are able to be recognized. So when you get to the end of the year, when you look at the annual transit reports, about 25%, it was down a little bit this past 2012, but I think close to 30% a year ago and the year before that, is being actually provided by local revenue, property taxes, and fares. So I'm going to make that point very clear that out in greater Minnesota, we are doing a consummate share to what they are receiving in fares in the metropolitan area. We have a comprehensive plan that we did that went out to 2025. That was done in 2009, funded by MnDOT. And we have our current base, 79,000 service hours. And we had a plan to, we called it our moving forward. It's now called our not moving forward plan, actually, but we have a staged plan to deal with congestion, to deal with unserved areas and underserved areas in our system, and you can see the dollars that are needed to do that. And essentially right now where we're sitting, we had hoped to implement this plan in 2011, and everything at this point has been delayed. Our Transit Authority Board actually levied a 10% property tax increase 2 years in a row on our levy rate, percentage rate in St. Cloud to start banking money for our moving forward plan. And we actually have an internal fund at St. Cloud MTC that has about an $800,000 balance that is not being spent. It's not being spent. The majority of it, about 85% of it, is not being spent. We are spending some of it to provide some of the growth in the transition phase for the city of Sartell. But beyond that, we're able to do our share locally, but until the state and federal government can step forward, we really can't move this plan forward.
Representative Hausman, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question about what funding source might be helpful. You perhaps know that the governor is proposing that in the 7-county metro area that there would be a sales tax imposed for a faster build-out to meet the needs. Might that be a solution statewide for transit, more rapid transit build-out responding to the needs?
Yeah. Chair, Representative Hausman, thank you for that question. Yes, I know the governor stayed silent on the MVEST question, and there's a variety of potential funding mechanisms out there that could help greater Minnesota. But, you know, we have not kept up with MnDOT's plan for growth. We're about 500,000 hours behind schedule to where we want to be in 2015, and we don't see that happening unless there's some significant funding. I know, the TFAC committee recommended some MVEST changes in leased vehicle MVEST, but, you know, I wouldn't say that that's the only source, but we definitely would like to do something. As president of MPTA, our association is part of Transit Partners, and we, of course, have the plan to try to increase investments by about $30 million or more in greater Minnesota. And I'll talk about that later, what we could do with some of that increased funding.
Thank you.
I just wanted to highlight two major projects that we have going on in St. Cloud. We received $1 million grant from MnDOT Central Office last year at the end of the session. And we have a 10,000 square foot building in downtown St. Cloud that is being renovated. It's been empty. It's a government-owned building. It's been empty for 4.5 years. We are building Minnesota's first, but for rural Minnesota, the first mobility and assessment center, travel training center for transit in St. Cloud. And we see that as a potential for a collaboration in Region 7W as well for a variety of different types of government projects. The other is Secretary LaHood was in St. Cloud this past September, and we competed on a clean fuels grant that was provided by the federal government. We were awarded $3.3 million for that. We competed against $590 million in applications. There was $47 million in money that was actually allocated, and St. Cloud received a very rare 80% funding for the clean fuels grant program. So we just awarded our engineering contracts yesterday, and by the end of 2013, we will have our fast fill fueling station in place, and we will also have be taking delivery in the first quarter of 2014 of the first 10 new flyers that are CNG-powered clean fuel buses. Our local investment is about $800,000 on that project. Our first 18 buses will save $500,000 a year in fuel costs at today's current fuel prices. So that was a very exciting project. In fact, before we received that federal grant, our board was about to revenue bond for that based on that rate of return for us. And that's all I have for that presentation. Questions?
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Beard?
Mr. Chair, I just have to applaud you on moving ahead on the CNG project. I've involved a little bit with that outside of this place, and I know that there actually is real rate of return that you can, that's very tangible, very concrete, and that you're moving ahead with that. I just want to say way to go. And thanks for buying New Flyer, too. And I don't own stock in New Flyer, Mr.
That's
Chair.
Okay.
It's just a local team, and I'm just glad to see him doing business with them.
Thank you. Great. Well, I appreciate your presentation, and Mr. Jensen, did you want to do the MIPTA one now, or do you want to have Mr. Jensen?
Why don't I have Mr. Chair? Why don't I have Dennis go ahead and do his, and then I'll follow up with the MIPTA.
Okay. We'd, I think, try to wrap up this section by about 11:15 if we can. Is that realistic, or?
Yes.
10 minutes. Okay. And Mr. Jensen, thank you. It's great to see you again. I had just to let the committee know shortly, back in December, shortly after I was, it was indicated that I would be the finance chair. I have scheduled a number of different trips out to Greater Minnesota, and I had a chance to meet with some of the St. Louis County Highway folks, and then I had a wonderful afternoon and tour of the facilities for the Duluth Transit Authority. So I wanted to publicly thank you for your hospitality, and I enjoyed that visit a lot. So
thank
welcome
you,
to
Chair.
The committee.
We don't get a chance to show off very often, so I also appreciate the opportunity to come down today and educate the committee on the Duluth Transit Authority. My my explanation is, or my presentation is really going to be just that, acquainting you with the Duluth Transit Authority and some of the programs that we have in effect. And there are a lot of similarities between the DTA and St. Cloud. They're very similar systems, so I won't go into a lot of the financial aspects of it. Our needs are the same as St. Cloud. I'd also like to state, just so the committee has a little bit better understanding of the quality of transit that exists in outstate Minnesota, recognized St. Cloud Metropolitan Transit Commission was recognized by the American Public Transit Association twice for being the outstanding system in the nation in their class of system, and Duluth was recognized once. So I guess that makes them better than us, but still similar. The DTA operates our regular route service and our STRIDE, which is our ADA paratransit service. That's an acronym for Special Transit Ride. We operate in Duluth, Proctor, and Superior, Wisconsin, and also we operate some service out on the edges of Hermantown. 26 routes, 16 schedules. We have 63 buses in our fleet. I will point out they are all Gillig buses. We are going to be going out to bid later this fall for new buses. We anticipate that New Flyer will be an aggressive bidder on those buses. Our annual ridership has topped 3 million for the last 5 years. And then moving to the budget, our total budget is $12.7 million. We recover approximately $3.8 million from system revenues. Our funding, we have a property tax levy as well. That was approved twice. We had it confirmed once. The city elected not to implement the actually to exercise the levy on behalf of tax. They went from the general fund, and then we had to go back to the referendum again, and it was approved again. Our state funds include both our JARC funds, which is Job Access Reverse Commute, which Mr. Schadenauer will talk a little more about when he gets up here with MnDOT, and then our federal operating assistance, which is $1.2 million. Some of the programs that we operate at the DTA includes our bike on buses. We are one of the first systems in the country to put a 100% accessible fleet on the street with bike racks. It began in 1994, and this past year we topped 27,924 bikes. We went to year-round, I believe in 2009, and the reason we did that because there's such a demand for bicyclists that they wanted the racks on the buses all year long. We had taken them off before during the winter months just to prevent corrosion on the bike racks. Then we moved to a stainless steel bike rack, and our ridership continues to participate in the bike and bus program all year long, which you can see from the chart is pretty exceptional for the city and with the weather the Duluth has. Our ridership on our paratransit services is approximately 27,000. It holds pretty steady. We have a very strong network of providers in the city of Duluth. We have the United Day Activity Center. A lot of Arrowhead Transit also operates some services within our region. So the demand for our paratransit services remain rather constant throughout the years. And keeping in mind, of course, that all under the ADA Act, all regular route buses are wheelchair accessible, so we also carry a pretty good number of wheelchairs on our regular route buses, approximately 8,200. Tony mentioned the UPass program at the college, or St. Cloud State. We also had that program at the University of Duluth, Minnesota Duluth. We started that in 2000. This has been seemingly probably the most successful ridership program we've ever established at Duluth. We just surpassed our 5 millionth rider this past January. We also now have the participation in the UPass program of every higher education institution in the metropolitan area of Duluth. That includes the College of St. Scholastica, Lake Superior State College, and also UWS in Superior. And LSC just hit their millionth pass year in November of 2012. Under that program, all students are allowed to ride free by showing their pass ID. We work out contracts with the individual universities that cover a portion of the fare and of the cost of the service. And it has just been phenomenal success. And it's more than just providing access to the college for the students. It also then, in the case of UMD, it allows the university to look at college or capital programs in lieu of such as new facilities and classrooms in lieu of building parking ramps. And I think they have now unused parking passes that still sit on the shelf each year because students no longer have to depend on the car to get back and forth to college. They have access through the bus system. We have park and ride lots, and this speaks a little bit to the future. The DTA, as I mentioned, provides service within the greater community, but we're also looking at in the future as providing a regional transit service. We receive requests frequently from persons riding up in the Two Harbors area, Cloquet, and then in the first ring of townships surrounding Duluth as to when they can expect public transit service. So the DTA board will be looking at a regional transportation authority at some point in the future in our 10-year plan. I've included a sign on a slide on our environmentalism, and this gets into some of the ways that we try to conserve our resources. Includes the bike and bus and the park and ride lots, but more in the actual facility itself and the recycling of materials and products. And in regards to the St. Cloud initiative to move to CNG, Duluth will watch that very closely, and we've already talked to St. Cloud about the budgets they projected and the cost savings. The main obstacle that is, of course, capital cost, and I think the fueling station runs about $1 million, if I'm correct, $2 million. So that is something that we would look at and probably partner with the city of Duluth. We've already talked to them a little bit about establishing a fueling station, which both their city vehicles and the Duluth Transit Authority would share. So that is in our future plans. We also have our downtown transit center, which was opened in 1987, and other major stops throughout the community. But the big project we have, and move the next slide, is our multimodal center. And this will be, construction will start on this project this fall. This is a $27 million off-street terminal. It'll be a true intermodal terminal. We will be serving not only our DTA bus routes, also intercity routes, which include Jefferson Lines and Indian Trails out of northern Michigan. It is located approximately a block and a half from what we hope someday will be the future commuter rail service between Duluth and the Minneapolis area. It's connected to the major skywalk, connects the downtown to the Duluth Arena. I experienced just a situation this past couple weeks ago when I went to a hockey game and I could not find a place to park at the arena. I had to drive back downtown and go through the skywalk. This will also provide 377 additional parking spaces in the downtown area. So we're very excited about this. It provide a, as I said, an off-street loading and boarding area for the not only the DTA but all the other associated carriers, and also it'll be the a bike storage area. The city is changing their ordinance now, which will allow the bicyclists coming up the Munger Trail and North Shore Trail coming down will be able to walk their bikes through the Skywalk system to the transit center and then access the public transit system. And these are just some elevations that will show, you know, ideally what it's going to look like. We are out for a design-build contract that will be Bids will be received on February 28th, and we'll be awarding that contract on March 13th, and construction we hope will start in this fall, in August or September. And these are, again, some slides of the facility. I've added one last slide here, and this will show you why we need this facility. Within that group of people going across the street, there is a wheelchair. And it's being assisted by other pastors, of course. But this is just this is our current downtown stop, our major downtown stop in the city of Duluth. And it shows you a little bit some of the reasons why we think this new center is going to be a big asset to the system and to the ridership.
Thank you. And I was very impressed when I went up there with your vision for this multimodal station. And I've been talking to Representative Benson and some other people, Rochester, the Mayo people. It seems to me that this is a good model that they could use. I think they're in need of that. I don't know to what extent St. Cloud has something like this, but I think this is a really good model for our regional centers, the multimodal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're very excited.
Representative Hausman, and then we're going to likely need to move on, and I'm not sure we'll have to figure out what to do with this MIPTA presentation, but Representative House.
And Mr. Chair, I do this as much for your benefit as anyone else, but I hope we note on one of the slides, the local tax levy, $1.3 million, state funding for them, $7.2
million. Yes.
And that you suggested might be a good model for Rochester. Just in light of, again, equitable funding, one of the things I would raise is if that's a good model for Rochester and Duluth, is it a good model for all of transit?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, we have to have a variety of sources for funding. Are there any other questions? How would you want to handle this, MIPTA? Because we have 10 minutes left and one more presentation, so.
Mr. Chair,
you want to very quickly go through this?
If I
very
could, MnDOT has very similar information on the front page. So what we could do is just go. I want to cover the last item on the bottom of the first page,
okay.
However. My mother, 37 years with MS in Traverse County, Minnesota, no real public transportation in that area. Spent her last 17 years of her life in the Stearns County, or Wheaton nursing home. So I just want to point out that in rural Minnesota, a big issue is aging in place and not having to sell the home, move into town. Nursing home care and assisted living care is very expensive versus giving the mobility to stay in your home and age in place. With that, flipping to the back side, as I said, MnDOT in their presentation will cover a lot of the same things that I did. I like to break down, this is the preliminary unaudited 2012 ridership numbers for Greater Minnesota, 11,460 trips. That's a 3% increase over 2010, a 5% increase in the urbanized area since 2010, and a 21.5% increase over the period from 2003 to 2008. So ridership really growing in Greater Minnesota. 215,000 of those are the federally required ADA mandated trips in the large urban areas, 2% overall of the Greater Minnesota ridership. And I always like to point out that St. Cloud is almost 50% of all the ADA ridership in Greater Minnesota, primarily because of the characteristics of our four-city area. The urbanized areas generate 67% of all the ridership in Minnesota. Their budgets account for 44% of the total costs in Greater Minnesota, to put that in perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Callan, very much. And members, will, of course, I think all of our panelists are accessible to us if you have follow-up questions that you haven't been able to think of now. And we will stay in touch, and I hope to be in St. Cloud and work with you in a few weeks here. So.
Thank you.
Okay, members, we have one final quick presentation. I hope that, Mr. Schottenauer, this gives you enough time. I feel we had a pretty crowded agenda here, and I apologize for that. But we can get a little bit of Greater Minnesota Transit 101, here just for our last 10 minutes, and obviously members have the in your packets this PowerPoint. So, Mr. Schottenhauer, you can't get through all of it. Members, at least feel free to refer to it. And Mr. Schottenhauer is here locally and would be, I'm sure, happy to visit with you or talk to you on the phone if you have additional questions. So, with that, we have 10 minutes left, Mr. Schottenhauer, and go to it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. I'll try to be as quick as I can.
And please state your name for the record.
My name is Mike Schottenhauer. I'm the director of the Office of Transit for the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and I'll try to give you a quick snapshot of Greater Minnesota Transit, kind of a summary of much of what you've heard from St. Cloud and Duluth. Greater Minnesota Transit has 58 different transit providers, at least a snapshot in 2012. The large urban six include the two you just heard from, St. Cloud Metrobus and Duluth Transit Authority. Rochester's the third of the big three, and then there's three others in smaller communities. There's also 12 small urban transit systems and then 39 rural systems. Plus, we also provide transit funding to North Star Commuter Rail for the portion of that route that's outside the seven-county metro area for the state share of the operating subsidy. Just to be clear, MnDOT provides grants, both federal and state grants, to public transit outside the seven-county metro area only, not inside the seven-county metro area. This map illustrates the coverage that we currently have, and there's a statute that instructs MnDOT to provide transit services throughout the state to meet the needs of transit users. We're not quite all the way there yet. You can see here that there's two counties, Waseca and Wilkin, that have no transit, no public transit service at all. And then there's another eight counties that might have a municipal system, but not something that extends across the entire county. And I'd also like to mention that although the green counties have countywide service, it can be pretty sparse in that it might be one route that serves the community once a month sometimes for some of the less densely populated communities. As you heard, ridership in Greater Minnesota Transit has been growing, and the unaudited figures for 2012 show it about equal to 2011 at just under 11.5 million riders. Transit is important in Greater Minnesota, much like you heard from Mr. Coles for the metro area. The top figures have to do with overall statistics for Greater Minnesota Transit, and then the figures below the line take some snapshots into some of the subgroups of that transit. You can see that people use it for work and school, but as you dive into some of the rural transit areas, it gets very important for seniors and trips that they need to get to medical services or to shopping needs. Many of the investments that we make in Greater Minnesota Transit are based on what we did in the 2011 Transit Investment Plan, and we set some criteria there where we initially start in the middle at preservation, and then we work our way up to expansion or down to contraction depending on the resources that we have available. So these just describe our strategies in all those scenarios. I will dive in a little bit to just mention that as we did that investment plan, there were some statutory goals set that we are responsible for reporting against. So one of those goals was to meet 80% of the needs by 2015 and then 90% of the needs by 2025. I can report, you can see the statistics on the bottom, for 2011, the last full year we have statistics, we were meeting about 63% of the needs, so we're not there yet with the 80%. I quickly want to mention some changes that are coming in. I believe you've heard about the new federal transportation law, Moving Ahead for Progress for the 21st Century. That's going to have some impacts on Greater Minnesota Transit. You already heard how the job access reverse commute funding has been folded into the urban and rural funding streams now for Federal Transit Administration. Also, the new Freedom funding source has been folded into the elderly and disabled. In general, those new sources have, in the consolidated funding streams, they have about the same amount of money as they used to have separately in their other streams. So it won't have a huge impact to Greater Minnesota Transit as much as I think some of the capital issues might pop up. What we're seeing is that for Greater Minnesota Transit, there are some federal streams that are changing greatly for capital. In the past, there were several discretionary sources available that have dried up in the new federal law. And instead, there's formula funds that are going to provide a little bit higher per year funding to the Greater Minnesota Transit capital programs than we had in the past. but without the discretionary programs, which we are pretty successful at, our total will likely be lower. And then that's compounded by the fact that there's going to be less surface transportation program money available. And that's something that the area transportation partnerships across the state would make decisions about for their areas. And in the past, they've been quite good about dedicating some of that money towards their local transit systems for bus purchases. It looks like starting in about 2017, after some of the state transit improvement program commitments for the period before that are taken care of, that surface transportation program funding is going to drop maybe about in the half what it was in the past. So even if the area transportation partnerships can put the same percentage of money towards buses, there just won't be as much available. It'll be about half as much. So I'll try to show you what that means from a funding perspective for us. This is what the funding looks like from our different sources, federal, state, and local. And you can see that it seems to be growing pretty well. These figures are based on the general fund coming in at the rate that was set by the 2011 legislature for the baseline. It's based on the forecast from MMB for motor vehicle sales tax and lease sales tax. And it's based on the federal amounts that we're getting now staying equal. So you can see that there's a growth here, but we're concerned about some aspects of this. And one of those is that the motor vehicle sales tax, especially the lease part, can be a little bit wild in how it comes in against forecasts. So just to set the stage for that, motor vehicle sales tax forecasts have been pretty good. You can see for the last couple years, the red line indicates what the actual amount was that was produced under regular MVST, and that was pretty close to what the recent forecasts were. But if you look at the leased motor vehicle sales tax, that's bounced up and down quite a lot, and it's actually been to the favor of Greater Minnesota Transit the last couple years, where a lot more came in than was expected. We're worried that that might come in on the low end instead of on the high end sometime, especially if the economy takes a spin down. At the same time, then, I mentioned the traditional vehicle funding going down, so this illustrates that, and you can see that the blue lines, the surface transportation program funds, were expecting to be reduced quite a bit. So you combine the money that we had for overall operations going up with this money going down, we're going to have to address that difference. One of the ways we'll probably have to address that is to use some of the state funds that are eligible to be used for operations or capital, more for capital than we have in the past, in order to make up for this and keep our fleet in a state of good repair. Just to quickly summarize some of the things we're doing then, we've had an initiative that we call Transit for Our Future, and in that we are emphasizing the three C's of coordination, cooperation, and consolidation. Our effort is to improve transit for the citizens of Greater Minnesota, but at the same time try to improve the efficiency in which it is run. So coordination means for transit agencies to work with their surrounding transit agencies, maybe blur the boundaries between transit agencies and provide transit across those boundaries without any notice to the, or any inconvenience, I should say, to the users. It could also mean working with other transportation government agencies or government agencies to provide transportation, like veterans organizations or departments of human services, just find better ways to work in that and share resources in that realm too. Same thing for cooperation, just finding ways to work better together. And then consolidation, some of our smaller transit agencies are now merging with larger transit agencies around them, because they find that that provides better service for their users, as well as maybe reducing some of the administration costs that are associated. On that same coordination topic, there's also a Council on Transportation Access that the legislature established about 2.5 years ago. And that is a 13-agency effort to look at better ways to coordinate transportation provided by the government. And we're a big player in that. It's chaired by our Assistant Commissioner Tim Henkel and staffed by MnDOT and Human Services employees. And then finally, I'll just mention that you can get a lot more information in our annual transit report that should be coming out in the next week or so here.
Thank you, Mr. Schottenauer. Amazing. You were able to get it done, so we really appreciate that. Members, before we adjourn, just a couple of quick things. Tomorrow, and thank you so much, and if you have questions, again, I'll call your attention to the thank you at the last page on the back. You have Mr. Schottenauer's email and phone number. Tomorrow, we're going to hear about the STIP, the State Transportation Improvement Program. I added this to the agenda because there was a lot of interest in the committee about corridors and specific corridors in your district and how MnDOT decides to fund those and other transportation improvements. So I think this will be interesting, especially for the new members, but us veterans can always use a little tutorial on the STIP as well and the current STIP plan that was just completed towards the end of the year. So we'll be going over that. And then, you know, after the 35W bridge collapse, it was all, that's what we talked about in this committee for many multiple sessions. There was a lot of interest in bridge safety and the state of the bridge program. And we just haven't heard a lot about that over these last 5 years. Obviously, we've had a lot of progress that's been made, but we've spent time on transit, we've spent time on roads. Let's not forget about bridges. So tomorrow we'll be hearing about the bridge program. Following that, then next week we're going to start to hear bills. And I wanted to let the committee know that we want to spend as much time as we can in the month of March before our Easter Passover break, which starts Friday, March 22nd. So there's not a lot of time. I want to encourage you to get your bills in. Mr. Scheer, well, first of all, jacketed and introduced, if you haven't, but then your hearing requests in to Mr. Scheer, so we can hear as many bills as possible before our break. And it's my intention that after break, we really start to put together our bill, our funding bill. And so if you want things included in that, we want to hear those first. And obviously then there's a process for putting the bill together, and we have amendments, et cetera. But as much of your ideas as we can get on the table and heard, I want to accommodate that. Again, I said at the beginning that anyone in this committee that wants a bill heard will get their bill heard in this committee. But you have to go through Mr. Scheer and get those requests in. So really, I want to spend the 6 or 7 or 8 times we meet, I haven't counted them exactly, in the month of March, solely dedicated to hearing bills if we can. So please get those in. I want to hear them. I want to hear your ideas, and we'll, you know, put our bill together right after the break. So with that, members, we stand adjourned.